This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, more city dwellers in Africa with more cash are buying more meat for the table. They're eating monkeys and other wild animals, and the critters are going fast. Maintenance of our national parks has been neglected, but now the money you spend to get in is being used to fix up what's inside. It's a start, but a lot more is needed. In our continuing series on the origins of life, two scientists describe a new way to find Earth-sized planets circling stars and if life is there. And on the Earth calendar, tiny white lady slipper orchids are blooming in South Dakota. These stories and more coming up on The Environment Show. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Dr. Jane Goodall, the world's leading authority on chimpanzees, appeared on The Environment Show a few weeks ago to discuss a number of environmental problems, such as the growing bushmeat trade in Africa. Bushmeat is wild meat, or any meat that does not come from domesticated animals. For many Africans, bushmeat is an important part of the diet. But as Stephen Westcott reports, logging activity and the increasing demands of urban dwellers with an insatiable appetite for wild game is destroying the biodiversity of tropical forests in Central Africa.
Scientists and experts alike say a lot of animals are being taken from Africa's tropical forests.
We are estimating that the wild meat trade is taking out something in the order of 1 million metric tons of wild meat per year. That level is 20 to 50 times greater than the harvest rates that we're seeing in areas where people are primarily hunting for subsistence.
That's Dr. John Robinson, Vice President and Director of International Conservation with the Wildlife Conservation Society based at the Bronx Zoo in New York City.
Most of the animals which are taken tend to be the ungulates, cow-goat family, and animals like duikers and pigs and things like this. Primates, a lot of the monkeys and apes, and the rodents, the large rodents. Those are the three largest groups. People take birds a lot as well.
Robinson says many of the primate species being taken are already threatened. He emphasizes that there is a limited number of the large mammals and birds that can be taken before their numbers become critically low. The animals are coming from the Congo and other tropical areas of Central Africa. Native people have hunted bushmeat for the past 40,000 years, so forest hunting is nothing new. What is new about today's bushmeat trade, according to Dr. Robinson, is the amount of meat being taken to feed people living away from the small towns and villages.
With the urbanization of the rural population, people have moved into the cities. They have retained a preference for wild meat. So the commercial trade in wild meat is supporting those meat preferences of what are now urban dwellers. And the greatest proportion of the wild meat trade is to support those urban consumers.
Wild animals have long been an important source of protein for Africans, and with a lack of large-scale domestic animal farms, they are continuing to rely on bushmeat as a food source. Besides the increased amount of meat being taken from Africa's forests, Dr. Robinson says the way the animals are being taken has also changed.
What is happening nowadays is that the large blocks of tropical forests are being opened up, and they're being opened up primarily because of logging companies moving into areas, and to get the wood out, those logging companies put in a vast network of roads. And that gives people access to the forest. It also gives people in the forest the ability to transport meat out. And so what we've seen as the logging front has moved into tropical forests, what we have established is this network that drains the meat out of the forest. And this is really a phenomenon that we've seen develop develop over the last 20 years in Asia. In Africa, we're seeing it developing right now.
Local hunters and hired poachers are involved in the bushmeat trade, but Dr. Robinson says local workers hired by European and Asian logging companies are taking most of the animals and transporting them to the towns and cities. Robinson says the governments of African nations simply do not have the resources to control the bushmeat trade. As a result, Dr. Robinson and others are going to the source of the problem.
We are beginning to work with, conservationists are beginning to work with logging companies to try to get them to close down their roads after they have used them to take out the wood, to supply meat to their domestic meat to their loggers, so that the loggers don't have to go out there and hunt wildlife populations, to encourage logging companies to prohibit the transportation of wild meat on logging company trucks.
Dr. Robinson doesn't believe the bushmeat trade dilemma can get any worse than it already is. He says unless aggressive measures are taken in the next 5 to 10 years, the only areas in Africa that will have significant wildlife populations will be some protected parks and preserves. For The Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
We move into summer, and it's vacation time. For some, that means a trip to a national park like Yellowstone, Yosemite, or the Great Smoky Mountains, or a lesser-known park such as we described last week. But as Ray Graff reports, there are some things you should know about our national park system before you load up the car.
The U.S. National Park System is the largest, and many say the best park system in the world. But according to a report released this spring by the National Parks and Conservation Association, private nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting the parks, crowds, noise, and pollution are endangering many of the 378 parks in the system. Tom Kiernan, president of the NPCA, runs down this year's list.
The 10 most endangered parks, as NPCA announced, included Taco Culture National Historic Park, Denali, Everglades, and Biscayne National Parks, Gettysburg National Military Park, Grand Canyon, the Great Smokies, Haleakala National Park, Mojave, Voyageurs, and Yellowstone National Park. Most of the problems that our parks face are reparable. Some, like protecting some of the species and the artifacts, that is not fixable. If we blow it now, we've blown it for our kids and our grandkids, and they will not forgive us.
According to the NPCA report, the range of problems facing the parks on the list is wide. Record-breaking air pollution at the Smoky Mountains National Park is limiting the once seemingly infinite visibility to a mere 20 miles on some days. At the Alaska Park Wilderness of Denali, snowmobiles, roads, and other intrusions are threatening the pristine environment. Yet Tom Kiernan says that perhaps the biggest problem facing the national park system is that there simply isn't enough money in its budget.
One of the fundamental problems underlying many of the challenges in our park system include lack of funding or completely inadequate funding. An example or a poster child is Yellowstone, where the lack of funding has led to sewage coming out of the sewage treatment plant into Yellowstone Lake and near Old Faithful. The cost to fix that is roughly $30 million, and the park's budget to handle all its other needs is $30 million. So there's no way that the Park Service budget can easily fix that problem without significant additional appropriations.
Well, I doubt there's any agency in the government that would tell you they couldn't use more money.
Destry Jarvis is Assistant Director of the National Park Service in charge of external affairs.
And certainly, for a number of years, the Park Service has said so.
Jarvis says recent additions in funding to the park system have made big improvements to some of the problems listed in the NPCA report. 2 years ago, Congress gave the National Park Service the authority to retain park entrance and user fees. Before that, the money had gone to the general fund of the U.S. Treasury.
And that essentially resulted in a $140 million increase in Park Service funding for operation and maintenance in the parks. All of that money stays with the Park Service and goes right back into visitor services and resource protection. So things like big ticket items that hadn't been handled very well in recent years because of lack of funding, many of them will get funded now through this $140 million increase.
But there are some problems that increased funding can't cure. One of the biggest is urban sprawl. Some national parks, like Mojave National Park in California, are being squeezed by increasing development. Again, Tom Kiernan of the National Parks and Conservation Association.
That park is under tremendous threats from surrounding development. There's an adjacent Army base that wants to expand its tank training area. There's also proposals for new resorts and new golf courses. That what was a park out in the middle of nowhere is now being surrounded on all sides by development, which is significantly impacting the health of the plants and animals inside the park. Some of the parks are turning more into zoos than naturally functioning ecosystems.
Both Kiernan and Jarvis agree that while there are many threats to our national park system that we can't control, the number one thing we can do to preserve our parks is, when we visit them, treat them with respect. Destry Jarvis of the National Park Service.
There are ethical and unethical ways to use the park. People who litter, people who cut off trails and cause erosion, people who feed the wildlife, all of these things are bad and will damage the parks. And if people know better, if they're informed or inform themselves, they won't do these things. People don't do it maliciously for the most part, although there is vandalism. But the vast majority of people are doing it in ignorance, and we'd simply like to help them learn from their experience in the park and take those lessons that they learn back home with them and do the same thing in their own neighborhoods.
You can learn more about the NPCA's list of 10 most endangered national parks and ways that you can help preserve them on the World Wide Web at www.eparks.org. For the Environment Show, I'm Ray Graff.
Coverage of the origins of life is made possible by NASA through support of the New York Center for Studies of the Origins of Life. It's located at the New York State University at Albany, the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, and the College of St. Rose. The Environment Show is a national production. It's made possible by the W. Walton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. You can always reach us here at the Environment Show by email. It's green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. Or write us, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. We'd like to hear from you. In our continuing series on the search for the origins of life, we talked to two scientists who are trying to find planets in orbit around stars. The idea is that these are places where there may be life or conditions that could lead to the formation of life. In an earlier program, we talked to Dr. Paul Butler, who has discovered planets circling stars by measuring how they cause the star to move. In contrast, a process called interferometry is being developed to see the planet directly. Jim Casting, professor of geosciences at Penn State University, explains the difference between these two techniques. He says in the first method,
the planet is pulling on the star and then it's causing it to wobble either back and forth in the line of sight, in which case you can look at the Doppler shift, that's called the radial velocity method, or it can wiggle side to side. And so if you can figure out the star's position very accurately, then you can see that it has a planet going around it. Both of those are indirect detection techniques, and what we're talking about with an interferometer is slightly different, because in this case, you're detecting the light from both the star and the planet coming, going around the star, but then you arrange the telescopes in such a way that you cancel out the light from the star, and you just retain the light from the planets going around it. So you're actually looking then at light coming directly from the planet.
Casting says what is detected is not visible light.
It's infrared radiation. It's longer wavelengths than visible light, but it is coming from the planet, and you know, in particular, it's coming from the planet's atmosphere. So if you can observe it, then you can figure out what gases are emitting it.
Accomplishing this is difficult because the star can be millions of times brighter than the planet.
Well, that's why you don't do this in the visible, because you know, the sun puts out most of its energy in the visible, and the Earth, of course, reflects some of that sunlight. But if you were to look at the Earth and the sun in the visible, you'd find out that the sun is something like 10 to the 11th times, 100 billion times brighter than the Earth. Well, that's impossible to overcome. But if you look in the infrared, the Earth's radiation peaks in the infrared. So the sun is still brighter, but it's only brighter by about a factor of a million or something in the infrared. And that, you know, even though that's a large difference, we think we can overcome that and still see the light from the planet.
Casting thinks that when these planets are seen, it will be possible to determine whether they're surrounded by gases that could relate to the presence of life. This conclusion is based on his studies of the evolution of our own atmosphere.
Suppose you were to look at the Earth, not now, but during the first half of its history. Most of us think that it didn't have oxygen in its atmosphere early on until about 2 or maybe 2.2 billion years ago. So if you were to look at a planet that was an analog for the early Earth, you wouldn't see an ozone band, presumably. But on the other hand, you might see lots of methane, because we think that on Earth, the methanogenic bacteria are very ancient. And if they were pumping out methane into an oxygen-free atmosphere, then you could build up quite a lot of methane, we think, enough to be able to see.
Dean Peterson, associate professor of astronomy at the State University of New York, Stony Brook, says the big breakthroughs in interferometry will occur in the next 5 to 10 years when NASA launches interferometers in space, equipment that is being developed now.
It's lights and mirrors, literally. You have this pair of mirrors out at each end of a large beam, 10 meters long in the case of the Space Interferometry Mission, which is the one I'm associated with. And you bring the two light beams together and you get just the wavelength of light. Interference pattern in the two light beams allows you to make an extremely precise position measurement.
Like all space exploration, putting an interferometer in orbit is expensive. Peterson reviews the cost of a single launch.
$480 million is in 1996 dollars is what they're counting. NASA has a funny way of keeping track of budgets. That doesn't count the rocket. You put the rocket in and run out costs and so on, and the real total cost beginning to end is $850 in round numbers. It's not cheap, but I mean, think of the return. I mean, the idea of dealing with these absolutely fundamental questions is just, it's mind-boggling.
Peterson said certain identification of planets by interferometry has not happened yet, but space launches of the interferometers now being planned for 2005 and 2010 will be the next big steps as we look for places where the elements of life might exist.
This is an extremely exciting time. It isn't just finding Earths and just going after life, which of course is the holy grail in all this, but we really know nothing about how planetary systems formed. And we will begin, we expect to begin to identify numerous planetary systems with planets of all masses, at all distances around their stars. We'll be able to see them around solar-type stars and hot stars and cool stars, and just start fleshing out the whole issue of how a star develops a planetary system. We just are absolutely in the infancy of that knowledge.
Researchers speculate that in the early part of the next century, we'll be discovering, with space-based interferometers, a great many planets orbiting stars. And as a result, the likelihood of finding places that have the necessary prerequisites for life will increase. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. As you listen to the show, small white orchids, which are a form of lady slippers, are blooming in eastern South Dakota. Susan Blotcher is a research associate at South Dakota State University located at Brookings. She says the wildflowers are found in clusters with up to 80 in one area.
If you've ever encountered a lady slipper in the woods, it's just so nice to come across and they just jump up and grab your attention. And the thing that makes these lady slippers distinctive is that they are so very tiny and so delicate. They're only about a half of an inch long, roughly, and oh, maybe 5 inches tall, something like that. They're a miniature version of the other lady slippers that most people are familiar with.
These lady slippers have three or four long, straight, narrow leaves that grow upward from the center of the stem. The flower has curled petals that can be colored with a delicate purple line. The flower resembles a slipper, and hence the name. As with many plants, Susan Blotcher says lady slippers are pollinated by bees.
And as they're feeding on some of these other wildflowers, they'll once in a while fly into an orchid, more or less by mistake. I guess the color or the fragrance, something about the orchid entices this insect to fly in, and then once it gets there, it's trapped, and it can't get out again without brushing against a bunch of pollen that's inside the flower. And this is maybe similar to other pollination stories you've heard, but of course, once it gets out of the flower and is carrying that pollen load, then if it makes that same mistake one more time, it has just succeeded in successfully pollinating an orchid.
Some say small white orchids smell a little bit like vanilla. These lady slippers are usually found in prairies and wetland areas. Susan describes this region of eastern South Dakota as prairie pothole with open rolling landscape. She says it's unique to find lady slippers in this part of the continental United States.
This is, as far as I know, the westernmost population known to exist. We have, I think, only about five populations of these orchids here in South Dakota, and the majority of them are to the east of here in the Great Lakes region and on actually over into the Atlantic states. So it's not very often that you'll find them in South Dakota.
Like many plant species, small white orchids have been pushed out of many regions as a result of development and agriculture. That means the slippers on the lady in the mall or the cornfield are not the real thing, even if they are petite and white. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, the International Whaling Commission has voted to restrict whale hunting for another year. Observers at the annual meeting say the Japanese are trying to blow the commission apart. We talk green about the livability agenda. It's a fancy name for a bunch of items in the federal budget, which Vice President Gore says will curb sprawl and make the country a better place to live. And naturalist Don Ogden reflects on the battle between beavers and the road boss. Whose space is a road traversing anyway? Stay with us. In recent weeks, representatives from across the globe gathered at the 51st meeting of the International Whaling Commission. That's the international body designed to manage and address issues relating to whales and whale hunting. Environmentalists have mixed views of the meeting, but more importantly, some believe the future of the IWC remains uncertain. This could prove fatal for some whale species. Stephen Westcott has more.
Those attending the IWC conference in Grenada say the meeting got off to a rough start.
There was a conspicuous effort by the Japanese to be disruptive, to intervene on points of order, and basically to try and discredit the IWC, I think with an intention of putting pressure on it to submit to their efforts to resume commercial whaling. They made a number of interventions themselves and through small island states in the Caribbean that are friendly to their interests that were really bordered on the undiplomatic. And they wanted to have television cameras in there, I think, with a view that they could publicly discredit IWC. And at least in the first day and a half, it was kind of a raucous meeting.
Richard Mott, vice president of World Wildlife Fund, based in Washington, D.C., was among those attending the IWC meeting. The International Whaling Commission was formed in the 1940s, but environmentalists and others say only in the past 20 years has the body effectively addressed whaling issues and whale conservation. During that time, debates between pro-whaling governments like Japan, Norway, and Russia and anti-whaling governments have increased. Richard Mott says this stalemate endured during the latest meeting.
The most critical event, I would say, was the tabling of a proposal by Ireland to reach a compromise solution. This was something Ireland had put forward about 20 months ago in Monaco, two meetings ago at the 49th annual meeting of the IWC. The Irish proposal was put forward again in Grenada, and it received a considerable higher level of support than it had at any point to date.
Ireland's proposed compromise would reportedly allow pro-whaling countries to hunt in their territorial waters while making international waters off-limits to whaling. A moratorium on whaling has been in effect for the past 13 years, but now countries such as Japan are hoping to lift the ban. But at least for now, it will continue for another year because IWC delegates voted to extend it. Richard Mott says Russia, which hunted whales for years, will be an important variable in the equation.
Russia has what is known as an objection to the commercial moratorium. Although it is not whaling today, it objected to the commercial moratorium, which allows it legally to begin commercial whaling any time that it wants. And if Russia resumes commercial whaling, it's a wild card on the international front, and it indicated at Grenada that it would oppose the Irish proposal and that it would promote relaxing of international trade bans on whale meat.
The next IWC meeting is scheduled for next June in Australia. Audrey Cardwell is an oceans campaigner for Greenpeace. I spoke with her immediately following the IWC conference in Grenada. She says the focus now shifts to a meeting of the Convention on the International Trade in Endangered Species, also known as CITES, where she expects efforts by Japan and Norway to lift the ban on commercial whaling to continue.
They are looking toward the Convention on International Trade and Endangered Species meeting next April in Nairobi. And at that time, they will move to take certain whale meat, most notably the minke whales, which they hunt extensively now, off the list of products that are not allowed to be traded because they're endangered. And once they do that, it means that countries such as Russia, and of course Japan and Norway, which have held what are called reservations against the moratorium, will then be encouraged to go back to full-scale commercial hunting because they will be able to sell their whale meat to Japan.
Despite the moratorium on whaling, countries like Japan and Norway continue to commercially hunt the majestic mammals, mainly because of an IWC loophole that allows countries to conduct what is called lethal scientific research, of which Japan is taking full advantage. Meanwhile, Richard Mott wonders whether the split between pro- and anti-whaling governments in the IWC will lead to a few whaling countries to break away and create their own governing bodies. He remains hopeful that Ireland's proposed compromise will be adopted at next year's IWC meeting. But if that does not happen, Mott believes commercial whaling could resume on a scale not seen for a generation. For The Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
My soul has been torn from me, and I am bleeding. My heart, it has been rent, and I am crying. As the beauty around me fails, and I am screaming, I'm the last of the great whales, and I am dying. Last night I heard the call of my last companion, the blast of a harpoon gun, and I swam along. I reflected on days gone by, when we were thousands, and I know that I soon will die, the last Leviathan.
We're Talking Green, and I'm Peter Burley. Today we're going to be discussing the livability agenda, which is included in the year 2000 proposed federal budget and is being much touted by Vice President Gore. We'll get into the details as we go along, but in summary, the livability agenda includes a Better American Bonds initiative to provide zero-interest financing for $10 billion in bonds to finance local acquisition of open space and to clean up old industrial sites. Also included is $6.1 billion for public transit, $1.6 billion for transportation planning, particularly related to reducing air pollution, and $50 million in matching funds for regional partnerships among local governments, specifically across city-suburb lines. My guests are Michael Replogle. He's Federal Transportation Director for the Environmental Defense Fund. That's a national nonprofit environmental organization. And also Greg Whetstone, who is Director of Advocacy Programs with the Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC, another national environmental group. They are both based in Washington, D.C. Michael Replogle, you are a transportation expert. Most of the money in this program goes for transportation. Does it make any sense?
This program makes a lot of sense. For decades, federal policies have fueled sprawl and traffic growth. This new set of policies gives communities vital resources that could reverse that tide.
And is there anything new here? Spending money on public transportation has been going on for some time. Transportation planning seems to go on ad infinitum, even though I'm not sure that too much is accomplished. Is this window dressing, or is there something substantive here?
No, there's real substance in giving flexible funding to communities and giving communities new tools to use that flexibility to deliver better communities with less traffic. These resources are particularly focused on spurring innovative programs that can help protect open space, revitalize our existing communities that are, many of which are in danger of disinvestment and falling apart, and that can help us to enjoy better access with less traffic. Those are real gains for everybody.
Greg Whetstone, if I'm a listener to the Environment Show and I hear about this thing, why should I really want to push my congressman or the administration to move ahead with it?
Well, I think that Michael's hit the nail on the head. There is a lot of money here that would provide opportunities for communities to really grow in a smarter way and take on the congestion and pollution and unchecked development that has really changed and is changing the landscape in the country.
Give me an example before you go on about what that would mean. If I'm a mayor or a local selectman, I hear you telling me there's money to grow in a smarter way. Specifically on the ground, that means what?
Well, it means things like money to assure that you can take advantage of opportunities to revitalize existing areas, to protect open spaces. Some of the reasons why people in this country over the past 20 or 30 years had in the past migrated from downtown areas, moved to suburbs. They were seeking open spaces in a way that kind of fueled sprawl. But it's become self-defeating in a way because there is now so much growth in the outside of the cities and so much sprawl that the open space that people were seeking is getting gobbled up.
And so is the issue here acquiring more open space around the outside of cities or building open space areas within existing urban areas?
Well, it's both. It's both in a big way. It's urban parks. It's renewing existing areas, and it's purchasing new lands. And I want to mention, Peter, there's another important aspect of the livability agenda that was a separate proposal but part of this package, if you will, which is the administration's lands legacy proposal, which is $1 billion to protect and acquire federal lands, open spaces, and some of which would be channeled through grants to states and local governments to similarly protect lands. And that this is money that is supposed to be being set aside for this purpose in any way, revenue from OCS oil development.
Now, that's been a program that's been ongoing for years. So, again, the skeptic says, what's different about doing something that we've been doing forever?
Well, I think it's been dramatically underfunded for years, and this is a proposal to set some of that money aside as it's supposed to be. Now, there may be some reason for skepticism, and we should maybe come back to how hard it's going to be to turn these programs into reality and to get them funded.
But we'll get to that in a minute, but it raises, I think, a fascinating issue. You say the program's been underfunded, but my understanding is that the money has been pouring in from the oil and gas leases, primarily in the Gulf, that have been going on for years, but the Congress has never allocated it to Soil and Water Conservation Fund for which it was intended. Is that what's been going on?
That is exactly what's been going on. This money has been coming into the federal treasury at a substantial rate, but has not been getting appropriated or spent on the purposes for which the fund was initially designed, which is to increase open space to protect the natural legacy of this country, the public lands that are going to be there not just for us, but for future generations.
And going back to transportation for a minute, Michael, what might we see in the public transportation area that would be different or new or enhance what's going on out there now?
Well, there are a lot of different pieces to this that can help communities solve their traffic problems and reduce air pollution that threatens public health. One of the components is a new federal tax policy that was put in place last summer called Commuter Choice, which represents a large hidden tax cut that most working Americans aren't yet aware that's available to them. Every American can today purchase transit benefits and van pooling benefits using pre-tax dollars, which will cut the cost of transit commuting for the average worker on the order of 40%.
How does that work?
Any American can ask their employer to allow them to have dollars withheld from their paycheck and use those dollars that are withheld buy transit passes or vanpool benefits, or if those aren't available in their community, the employer can give pre-tax cash dollars so employees can purchase access to vanpool program benefits, setting up these kinds of systems.
So what that means is if you're in a 20 or a 30% or even 40% bracket, you don't pay the full amount because this comes out before you start paying tax.
That's right.
Basically, the government pays 20 to 30% of your commuting transportation cost.
Well, and it saves on both the federal and the state income taxes. So, you know, for the average worker who faces maybe a $60 or $65 a month cost of a transit pass, which is typical in many cities and suburbs, that pass can be purchased using those pre-tax dollars, which cuts the effective cost to the employee down to on the order of $35 or so. The employer can also offer those transit passes and vanpool benefits for free to employees, and those are then non-taxable benefits, just like getting a parking space at work. And moreover, employers for the first time can offer cash in lieu of a parking space to employees. And this can be worth hundreds of dollars a year to employees who could use the money that right now they can only get by taking advantage of a free parking space by driving to work and clogging up the roads with traffic. Now, if people want to get into a carpool or ride a bike or use the bus to get to work, they can literally put hundreds of dollars more in their pockets at the end of each pay period.
Okay, let's talk politics for a minute. These appropriations are part of the budget, and they have to go through the Congress. And I noted some of the reaction to this, which I thought was predictable. Columnist Joe Blast for the Chicago Sun-Times says that this agenda would, and now I'm quoting, destroy many of the freedoms we take for granted. Environmentalists are not known for placing much value on property rights and liberties of humans, but why should the rest of us agree to such flawed and destructive plans? On the other side, writing for the Rally News and Observer, some officials at the National Wildlife Federation say we are at the cusp of a rare opportunity to build a permanent legacy that will benefit Americans for generations to come. So, given the fact that political thinking on this is by no means unified, what is going to be the fate of these proposals as the Congress thinks about them and does their thing? Greg, what do you think?
Well, I think I would connect the two issues. I think, in fact, that these proposals are very much in line with the thinking in this country right now. There have been a raft of referendum across the country. If you look in the last national election, there were some 240 different state and local initiatives aimed at reducing sprawl or protecting open spaces. More than 70% of those were enacted, despite the fact many of them were measures that actually included tax increases to pay for open space acquisition. So I think the public support is definitely there, and I have seen statements from across the political spectrum recognizing that the vice president with this agenda is tapping into something very real. Now, in my mind, it's a very different issue whether or not we have a real opportunity to get this enacted, because I think some of these are going to be very difficult to be enacted, despite the fact that they're broadly popular. But, you know, these battles, they don't end in one year or one Congress, so I don't think it's the end of the road.
Mike, how do you see this one, congressionally?
Well, I would agree with Greg Whetstone's take on this, that there's going to be some difficult battles in the Congress over some of these things. But clearly, smart growth strategies that help us to manage how we develop our communities and how we manage traffic are gaining bipartisan support at the state and the local level. There were 29 governors in their State of the State speeches who included themes supportive of smart growth this past year. The majority of those were Republican governors. We have folks in both parties working at the local level to try and build new consensus between business and environmental interests to help us give people better communities with less traffic.
The national home builders, who traditionally have been opposed to anything that looks like planning and the like,
came out in favor of the livability agenda. Does this indicate some of the shifts that you guys have been talking about?
I think it does. I mean, this is really about quality of life. To suggest, as the columnist that you quoted did, that somehow this is contrary to personal freedom is, I think, antithetical to what this is about. This is about people who want to have the option of living in a place where they don't have to deal with congestion and pollution and crowding and sprawl. And it's very much consistent with protecting quality of life, as so many environmental programs are. And I think that's why this is popular.
I think one of the things that may be happening also is that people, and I heard a recent report from Atlanta, are finding that this freedom to build whatever you want, wherever you want, is choking us. And indeed, Atlanta, apparently the commutes are getting longer and longer, and the air is getting worse and worse, and people are less and less happy about being there. I want to thank Michael Replogle from the Environmental Defense Fund, who has been with us, and Greg Whetstone from the Natural Resources Defense Council, both national nonprofit organizations, both working on growth issues and thinking about the passage of the proposed livability agenda, which is now part of the administration budget proposal. We know you have some thoughts about this, so give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. We've been talking green. And I'm Peter Burley. If you go to our website, you can listen to the Environment Show, and you can also respond to a questionnaire which we have there. The site is www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. We all have places that are special to us. For some, it's a city street. For others, it's deep in the wilderness. For naturalist Don Ogden, it's the hills of western Massachusetts, where he views efforts to keep the roads open a symptom of humankind's lack of regard for the natural world and its inhabitants. In this portrait of place, Ogden reads from his essay titled, The Road We Travel.
Here in the hills of western Massachusetts, I live with my neighbors in the Sawmill River Valley. The people who lived here before us, the Pocumtuk, called the narrow river of stone and water Sawadopsky Chuas. Their familiarity with the river could be measured in the thousands of years they spent by its banks, unknowing beyond our experience. Now, as then, those who dwell in this eastern woodland community are certainly not all human. We humans share the ancient presence of the river with the deer and beaver, the porcupine and fox, the blue heron, the hawk and the raven, as well as myriad other life forms. I'm happy to note that the number of four-leggeds has been growing. The beaver and fox are returning as once tilled fields yield to woods, but to the south, over in the next valley, the number of humans is increasing also. It is there that reforested land is cleared once more and houses on lots of a few acres are built, one after another. At the confluence of a brook with amber-colored waters, wandering down through marsh and woodlands, passing but one or two homes, the beaver has come to reclaim its home on the Sawadopsky Chuas. A family have lodged themselves by the confluence and changed the face of the river. Where there was once a meander with a few small islands, there is now a beaver pond. Nearly every day that passes, I watch the water pour over the beaver's dam and course down the river's channel, rolling and braiding, and further on, reaching rocks and ledge where endless trails and threads of sun-reflected liquid light stream over stone, churning the surface. I watch those waters as a gift, but also with some trepidation. I say this because the road boss is also eyeing the beaver pond with concern. The waters of the pond are a mere 5 feet from the roadbed, and the road is a main artery for people in these parts, just as the river is a major artery for the wildlife. The road boss was raised on the river's banks and no doubt knows it well. He may have a better sense or love of it than I, but his job is to keep the roads open. 2 years ago, before trapping was mostly outlawed in the state of Massachusetts, he felt obliged to have the last beaver family removed. Apparently, towns still have that option under certain circumstances. The present occupants of the beaver lodge may be living under borrowed time. It's a disturbing situation. These things happen often as our expanding automated society rubs up against a more sedate yet fluid one, which finds little value in long stretches of asphalt, which can easily spell disaster for them. It is, though, just this clash of cultures that leave us considering what we have done during our stay here on Earth. Every day, people make little decisions which place our species ahead of the needs of others. It is done so often we barely think about such actions anymore, until a relatively larger life form, which happens not to be human, sets foot upon the road we travel.
That was Don Ogden reading his essay, The Road We Travel. Ogden is a naturalist who resides in western Massachusetts. Thanks for being with us in this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. Would you go to a meal of bushmeat and whale blubber if there were lady slippers on the table? This program, number 493, can make you think about it. Call 1-800-323-9262. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Chartok is executive producer, Stephen Westcott is producer, and the show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. Be good to the Earth, and join us next week for the Environment Show.